This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Thanks for downloading this episode of In Our Time. There's a reading list to go with it on our website, and you can get news about our programmes if you follow us on Twitter at BBC In Our Time. I hope you enjoyed the programmes. Hello, William Cecil, 1520 to 1598, was at the centre of power in the Tudor world for over 50 years, from the death of Henry VIII to the advent of James I. He advanced under the boy king Edward VI, survived under Mary, and thrived under Elizabeth, and the Protestant cause flourished with him. He was Elizabeth's most trusted adviser, yet he went behind her back to have Mary, Queen of Scots, executed, and he both encouraged Elizabeth to marry and blocked her from marrying. With me to discuss the life and times of William Cecil, Lord Burley, are Diarmaid McCulloch, Professor of the History of the Church at the University of Oxford, John Guy, Fellow of Clare College, University of Cambridge, and Susan Doran, Professor of Early Modern British History at the University of Oxford. John Guy, how close was William Cecil to the centre of power when he was born?
He's born on the periphery of power. His grandfather, David Cecil, was a sergeant-at-arms to Henry VIII. His father, Richard Cecil, is a page of the chamber. That's a relatively lowly official in that part of the king's household, where the king does appear from time to time, but he was promoted to be a yeoman of the wardrobe. And that was more than just looking after the king's clothes, many of which were in themselves hugely valuable. It also included furniture and very valuable tapestries. I think, though, that the most important connection, because clearly this is part of a court network, was his grandfather. His grandfather was Sir David Philip, and he had been a leading household official for Henry VIII's grandmother. And it was because of David Philip that the Cecil clan were, if you like, settled in the area around Stamford, the Lincolnshire, Northamptonshire, Rutland, where they accumulated a reasonable amount of land. So, if you like, he's in the food chain, but quite low down.
What did it matter that he had a humanist education at Cambridge?
Well, this is the most important thing, because he wasn't sent to Eton or Winchester, which were schools then for relatively poor boys, you know, for whom their parents envisaged careers. He was educated, first of all, in simple church schools by a parish priest, but he went to St John's College, Cambridge, and that was a crucial connection because it was also a college found by Lady Margaret Beaufort. And there he learnt...
What's the significance about her?
Because of course that's the connection with the Cecil clan. It was the obvious place for someone who had been connected to Sir David Philip to go. But there he learnt mainly classical languages, Latin and Greek. He learnt rhetoric. And he learnt moral philosophy. Well, of course, classical languages, Latin and Greek, were the languages in which you then studied rhetoric and moral philosophy. The point about rhetoric was that today you would probably call it the art of persuasion. It was how you learnt to argue a case, how you learnt to put arguments for and against a topic, how you learnt to reach a reasoned conclusion. And, of course, Cecil later in life became the arch persuader. Silkily smooth, devious, brutally brutal by all means at his disposal. Moral philosophy, the essence of that was really the Ciceronian world of the high days of the Roman Republic. And so one of the main texts he learnt there was Cicero's De Officiis, on duties, and it was later said of Cecil that he never went anywhere without a copy of De Officiis, either in his bosom or in his pocket. The point about this training was it prepared you either to be a secretary to a leading nobleman or for counsel. It prepared you to actually enter the political world. And these subjects were at the heart of the Renaissance curriculum that courtiers were supposed to learn.
He also made very good connections with two of the most brilliant men of his time. And he married, in each case, into the first wife, one of them, who his wife died, and then the sister of another of them.
Absolutely. Because his main tutor, especially for Greek, was John Cheek. And John Cheek later, of course, became the tutor to Edward VI, which gave Cecil quite an entree. But of course, I think Cecil, it was said of Mary, Queen of Scots, that she once said, "Not to marry, you know, it cannot be for me." And in some ways, Cecil was the marrying kind. He married Cheek's sister, who had a relatively lowly status as effectively a sort of pub. Pub landlady. It couldn't last because she died, but they had one son. But he then stepped up the ladder because he married Mildred Cook, the daughter of Sir Anthony Cook, who had a number of highly intelligent, well-educated daughters, and she was also educated in the humanist curriculum, and they were quite a power couple.
So he learned from his own experience what became one of his great powerful instruments, which was this modern word, networking.
Absolutely. Networking, but also persuasion, rhetoric. I mean, he would have been, if the perfect, if you like, PR and publicity consultant, you know, for some great corporation if he'd lived today.
He came from a Protestant background. How secure was Protestantism when Edward was king and Cecil was working for Edward's protector Somerset?
Well, desperately insecure, because Henry VIII's reign had been a break with Rome, but the king had not committed himself really to either side, Catholic or Protestant, in the Reformation turmoil. So when the boy king was there, his ministers, thanks to a lot of politicking, were basically Protestants, and Protestants by conviction. But the country was not. There was an active minority, particularly around London in the places that mattered, lots of Protestants. But the extraordinary thing about Edward VI's reign is just what an experiment it is. This is the largest attempt at a Protestant Reformation in the whole of Europe up till then. And it's being led by this tight, small group of politicians. Cecil is on the edge of them. I mean, he was secretary to Edward Seymour, who became Duke of Somerset in this regime. So he's very committed already. And the names that John Guy has fired at us, such as John Cheek, these are all early Protestants.
And when you say the boy king, are you using boy king in sense? How surprising that a boy king did this?
Well, the boy king at the heart of this, Henry's only son, Edward, was already a convinced Protestant. This is very mysterious. How did Henry VIII, the man who'd not committed himself, allow his son to be educated by undoubted Protestants? And that's a mystery. But he did. It's almost as if he was going to postpone the Reformation until he'd safely died. And this young man, or just a boy to start with, was a really hard-nosed Protestant, rather alarming his tutors and politicians by his, eventually teenage enthusiasm for Protestant religion.
And for the necks of Catholics, with executions of?
Well, not as such. Not all that many Catholics died politically under Edward. I'm not hedging my bets, because there were conservative Catholic rebellions against the government's policies, particularly in 1549, and a lot of people died. But really, they're dying for being rebels. They're not dying for being Catholics. And there were rebellions which were not Catholic at the time, and an equal number of people died. So let's not see this regime as a murderous Protestant regime. It was not.
Then he managed to continue to serve under Mary after the death of Edward, who was very much a Catholic, and others left the country or ran away, one thing or another. He managed to serve under. How did he manage that?
Well, I think by charm. John has talked about persuasion, but actually there's no doubt that this man had charm, because under Edward he transferred seamlessly from one politician, Seymour, to another politician, Dudley. They were deadly enemies, and yet Cecil had served them both. Now under Mary he had that charm still. He also had connections. He had a brother-in-law whose wife, this is Nicholas Bacon by name, his wife was a serving woman to the Queen, and she's clearly crucial, though she too was Protestant. You see, you did have Protestants who would quietly hang on. You've mentioned people who fled abroad and other people were arrested and burnt at the stake, but some Protestants quietly just got on with being Protestants until better times came, and the most important among them was not Cecil, but the Lady Elizabeth, heir to the throne. This is the half-sister.
She'd been stripped of her title by Henry VIII, so she couldn't be called princess. She
was
the lady.
Had been the Lady Mary as well. Yeah. But now the Lady Mary was Queen Mary, and the Lady Elizabeth was heir to the throne, and you couldn't ignore that fact. And she was undoubtedly a Protestant, but like certain others, including Cecil, she quietly kept waiting for better times.
So, Doran, when he first started to work for Elizabeth, he had been in touch with her for a while under Mary, hadn't he? Could you tell us how he worked that relationship?
Yes. We've talked about networking and circles. They had overlapping circles. Both of them knew Catherine Parr, who was Henry VIII's last queen, pretty well. Elizabeth's tutor was Roger Ascham, who had been at Cambridge, a tutor of William Cecil. So one of the kinsmen of Cecil was Thomas Parry, who was in charge of Lady Elizabeth's household. So they knew each other, not necessarily face to face, but in terms of having connections in common. The first letters we have between the two of them date back to Edward VI's reign. Whether they had met before then or not, we don't know, but I suspect they had. The letters are pretty formal. They're Elizabeth usually asking for some favour from Cecil, who by that time was secretary. And they're also to do with Elizabeth's land, because Elizabeth's father, Henry, had left Elizabeth's land in Lincolnshire. As we've already heard, Cecil's also had lands in Lincolnshire, and his family had been surveyors of the portions of land, the great estates that Elizabeth was to inherit, and then Cecil came in to be the surveyor of the land. So they had a pretty working relationship. Now, it seems too...
So in that sense, he put her house and her finances in order, did he?
Well, not her immediate household, but certainly her estates. So he showed himself to be an effective businessman and an honest one, which was to be very important to Elizabeth. It's one of the things she said about him when she made him her secretary, that she could trust him, and she meant in terms of his probity. We also know that almost certainly, you mentioned the fact that she was called Lady Elizabeth. She wrote a letter to Cecil suggesting that there might be another title she could have, because it wasn't much of a status to be just a lady. She couldn't be called a princess. And it seems that he wrote to her and suggested, though we don't know this for certain, that she called herself the sister of the king, which was a neat way of getting out of calling herself the daughter of the king, because that would put Mary's nose out of joint. So they had these kinds of relationships before Mary's death. And in the last year of Mary's death, Cecil met Elizabeth, we know, at least twice. And it's very likely they discussed at those meetings what the Privy Council of Elizabeth would look like, what his position would be, and also what kind of policy she would follow.
When she became Queen, 1558, she made him her Secretary of State. What did she see in him? And he and her, but what basically did she see in him? It's an immediate appointment to a great state appointment.
Well, he'd done it before. That helped. He was somebody who would be experienced. He was a Protestant. And as I said, they had a working relationship that demonstrated that she could trust him. I think, and I don't know when it developed, that she also treated him as a kind of a good uncle. You know, she hadn't a father that she could have trusted. She had no male relationships that were really close and emotional. And I think that he filled that emotional gap for her.
John Guy, what was Cecil's agenda when he and Elizabeth became this unit?
Oh, he's absolutely got one. You know, from, I mean, not just day one from Elizabeth's reign, but before that, because he arrived on day one with one memo in his pocket. And there's another memo which he wrote called The Device for the Alteration of Religion. I mean, if you collate the two documents, the first one's in his handwriting, the second one deals with almost exactly the same issues as were in the first one. So I think it's fairly certain that he wrote both of them. The essential elements are, first of all, because England, of course, at the end of Mary Tudor's reign, was at war with France. There were French forces actually in Calais, which had been retaken by the French from the English garrison. The first one is to make peace with France at almost any price, because, of course, there was a real threat that once Elizabeth, you know, had declared her hand in religion, then there could be some sort of Catholic invasion. The second one is to settle religion and as quickly as possible. And there Cecil has his plan, which is that this should be an unequivocally Protestant settlement. It is not a compromise between Catholics and Protestants. However, it is a compromise within the Protestants. The most radical Protestants would be disappointed, and he knew that. But basically, it's an attempt to reach really on, if you like, Swiss Reformation lines, a coherent theological settlement, but one that must then be enforced. And then the third thing that concerns him greatly is Scotland, because, of course, there's a French army in Scotland, at least around Leith. And remember, we're in 1558 and then early 1559. Henry II, King of France, is still alive. And it was the policy of Henry II, who was very much influenced then by the Guise faction in France, which is the family of Mary, Queen of Scots. She's still quite young. She's still a young teenager, and she's in France, but she's not yet betrothed to the Dauphin of France. But the fact of the matter is that Henry II had, if you like, a Franco-imperial British policy, which was to take Scotland first and then take out England, and somehow create some sort of Franco-British empire. So this is really, really threatening, and Cecil is determined to deal with those things.
Had he any financial ambitions? Because the finances were in a rocky state, weren't they?
Well, this is another topic. Actually, on the first list, he instructed Sir Thomas Gresham, who was the Crown agent for finance. He was reappointed. He was told to effectively stop the export of capital from England to Europe. The English government then was in hock to a fair degree to bankers in Antwerp, but Cecil didn't want money leaving the country. But he wanted Gresham on hand to deal with all financial matters. And the really, really, really interesting thing is that although Gresham had been based and was based in Antwerp, he knew to be present on the very afternoon of Elizabeth's accession at Hatfield to kneel before her and, you know, and receive his own commission as the Queen's banker. So there has to have been collusion before the event between Cecil and Gresham.
Yes, he's always making these little connections, isn't he? And they turn up like that. Damn it. Can you tell us how the views of Cecil and Queen Elizabeth I coincided on Protestantism and how they decided to pursue it?
Well, they're both Protestants. Now, let's not escape that fact there. That's the bottom line. They're not identical, though, because Cecil had been associated with a really forward-driving revolution under Edward VI, and Elizabeth had been slightly distanced from that. She was a rather conservative Protestant. She liked ceremonial, and she did not like rapid religious change. So there's a bit of a tension there, and Cecil's job was to keep her on line with this very thoroughgoing Reformation. It's going to be a complete turnaround from Mary's Catholic Church. So there's a bit of a job there. He was still identified with this forward, dynamic sort of policy and religion, and everyone assumed that that meant change and change and change. What happened in 1558-9 was meant to be a sort of springboard for lots more change, and it never happened. So in that sense, the Queen's policy of keeping things quite controlled was the one which won. And you can see Cecil gradually falling behind that line, gradually falling in line with it over the next, 40 years, really.
So she won.
She did. But on the other hand, she was committed to a reformation which, as John says, looked to Switzerland, not the rather more conservative reformation of Martin Luther in North Germany. That's a victory for Cecil and the Protestants who felt like him. But frankly, by that stage, most Protestants felt like that. Lutheranism had sort of withered away in England. It's a rather mysterious thing. The future of the Church of England would be much more like that of Central Europe. People we might think of as Calvinists, that's an inaccurate word. People from Zurich, people from Geneva.
So, Darren, what Cecil seems to have specialised in was getting a lot of knowledge and being able to retain it and table it and work on it, and very efficient, extraordinarily hard working, and so on. How did he find out all he wanted to know about what was going on in Europe and Britain?
Well, first of all, he commissioned maps, and he would write on the maps. He commissioned a huge amount of documentation, and we can see a lot of it in the archive in the British Library, the Lansdowne Archive, and also in Hatfield House, where there's a big Cecil archive. Huge amount of material that he reads, obviously, because he, you know, he writes on a lot of it. So partly through reading, partly through talking to people, and partly through a network of informers that he uses. Some of them we would call spies, some of them are ambassadors, but they all come to him. The other thing that's really...
And he's working with Walsingham as well, isn't he?
Later on, he works with Walsingham. Yeah, yeah. He ceases to be the secretary and Walsingham in 1572, and Walsingham takes over from him after a short gap where there's someone who's not terribly good at it. So, yes, he works with Walsingham. And again, they have their own, as it were, separate coterie of informers, sometimes working together, sometimes working independently. And then later in the reign, that happens with the Earl of Essex. The Earl of Essex has his informers. But the great thing about Burghley, as he then becomes, is that he is remarkable in mastering detail. I mean, he had an extraordinary memory, and he used it in order to put forward the kinds of arguments John talked about, for and against. He didn't just put his own opinions. He gave information to back up those opinions.
Is there any way we could shortly describe what he was going for in collecting this intelligence? He had these maps, and he put on the map everybody of any consequence. That meant title and money all over, so he knew who to go for when he had to go for them. What about Europe? What's he going for there?
Security. I think what he's looking for more than anything else is to protect England from the Catholics. Well, he works out in terms of, say, Ireland, which are the vulnerable points to invasion, which of the lords there might support England, which might go over to the Spaniards. The same is in Scotland. He builds up relationships with the Scottish earls who are Protestant, seeks to know exactly what's happening with those earls, like the Earl of Huntly and others who are Catholic, whether they have relationships with Spain or with France. So he's developing an understanding of what the dangerous people are doing and who they might be conspiring with that will save England.
I think in the background of all this is that what he would know, and what every Tudor statesman would know, was that England was a second-rate power. It was not one of the big boys. It was not the equivalent of the King of France or the Holy Roman Emperor or the King of Poland. Those are the three big boys. And so any Tudor monarch has to face the problem of that. And you're not the main focus of Europe. But the real danger now is that the government had committed itself to a policy which was desperately unpopular with those three big boys. In other words, Protestantism. And so all the time there is this... A desire for security against the grain. You've got somehow to keep in control these other powers.
And that's linked, of course, with the problem of Mary, Queen of Scots, because it's not just that Elizabeth is insecure because she's a Catholic, because she's a Protestant, and there's these big boys. These big boys are looking to Mary, Queen of Scots, who could be either the heir or could seek to displace her.
So we have Mary's Queen of Scots, John, on the other side of the border. She's gone there now. She's the natural. She's the heir to the throne. She's also that she herself has a son who will be an heir. So he sees her as a great threat, a great nuisance. He calls her, but he means a great threat.
Mary is Cecil's obsession. He can't even in no state paper that I've ever found has he mentioned her name as such as Mary. She's SQ, the Scottish Queen. She's so dangerous in his opinion. She can only be named by an acronym, because what we've just been talking about morphs in Cecil's mind into the thesis of some grand Catholic conspiracy involving the Pope, Philip II of Spain, France, the Guise faction, all of those things in which there's going to be some great sort of crusade against England invasion in order to put Mary on the throne. And Mary is all the more dangerous because when she gets back to Scotland, before she's got back to Scotland, she makes Elizabeth an offer. And that offer is that she will resign her immediate claim to the English throne and recognise Elizabeth as the absolute rightful Queen of England if, in return, Elizabeth will name Mary as her heir, provided she herself does not marry and have children. And, of course, that offer was so reasonable. Several times Elizabeth took it quite seriously. Mary also proposed that if the two queens could meet woman to woman, they could settle their differences away from all these scheming men. And Elizabeth was... There were a number of occasions when Elizabeth was very taken with that idea, and the two queens very nearly met in 1562. It was stopped by the outbreak of the French Wars of Religion. But I have to tell you that Cecil had already written the equivalent of the press release cancelling the meeting 2 weeks before the actual event occurred that triggered the French Wars of Religion. So Cecil is not just sitting there in London, making his plans. He's actually actively funding the Protestant lords in Scotland. He's sending them gold coins illicitly, untraceable gold coins across the border. Later on, Mary, Queen of Scotland. Later on, he sends the Earl of Murray, who's the sort of the chief Protestant lord. He even sends him armaments, which I only found out about 6 months ago in the British Library.
What sort of armaments?
Basically bows. And arrows. It would have been too risky to send them guns, I think, but he sends bows and arrows, and those are used at, later on again. They're used in the armament store of the Protestant lords just before Carbery Hill. This is absolutely real. And Cecil sits up at night, to the equivalent of 2 o'clock in the morning, writing memos, what to do about Mary, because he knows that Elizabeth, in her heart, regards Mary as the rightful heir. And in fact, she said so. She said so quite early on in the 1560s. She actually says so to Maitland of Leffington, who comes south in summer of 1561, the Scottish Secretary of State, the Scottish Cecil. And she says that privately she knows that Mary is the true heir by blood and dynastic right. She just isn't going to name her for fear of conspiracy. So there's just one thing that we need to learn, that, if you like, the strap line for all of this is that Cecil becomes committed by all means at his disposal, fair or foul, to the preservation of the Protestant state.
And being committed by foul means to the execution of Mary, dammit.
In the end, we'd be jumping forward into the 1580s, but Mary by that time had associated herself with conspiracy, there is no doubt. And not only that, but the Scots had, to cut a very long story short, got extremely fed up with her as queen and chucked her out, considering that she had been implicated in the murder of one husband, implicated at least. And then she turned up in England in 1568, and not only is she a Catholic heir to the throne, but with a very dubious status, what do you do with her? She is the focus for conspiracy, whether she likes it or not. And that worried Cecil deeply, and continued to worry him until she eventually died.
Now, what were the stages? There were plots. There was the famous Babington plot. Somehow or other, Queen Elizabeth signed a warrant for her death, which she had signed, but she didn't mean it to be implemented. One of you take this up, because I think I'm on the right lines, but you can tell it better than I can. John.
Well, Elizabeth just didn't want to sign the death warrant because although by 1586, I mean, the thing about that is that the dynamics completely changed because Elizabeth and Cecil signed a treaty, an Anglo-Scots treaty with James. And after that, Mary had no hope of ever returning to Scotland, so she was willing to listen to conspirators. So she listens to the Babington plot. Evidence is found and she did undoubtedly condone... She did undoubtedly condone the plot.
The plot was to assassinate the Queen.
Yeah. Walsingham tripped up and actually lost the crucial piece of evidence, so they had to reforge it. But leaving that aside, even then Elizabeth won't sign the warrant, and Cecil gets her to sign the warrant. He has it in his pockets for several weeks by telling her that the Spanish Armada has landed a year early in Wales. A Spanish force has landed a year early, and they also
which it hadn't,
yeah. and they also conjure up a plot, or at least resurrect an old plot and pretend it's a new one. But the thing is that Elizabeth signs the warrant and then she has second thoughts. She steps back from it. She tells her secretary to keep it to himself and not to basically pass it on. She was surprised that he's even got it sealed as quickly as he did. Cecil meets him outside. He says, "Give it to me." He then summons a quiet, if you like, a secret cabal of privy councillors, selected privy councillors in his own chamber, and they decide to send the warrant, regardless of the Queen, and not to tell the Queen until the deed is done. And as a result of that, see, Elizabeth now is having it both ways. She may have perhaps suspected that this would happen, but the point is that now she can give Cecil the, if you like, the dressing down of a lifetime. And after that, he's much more cautious. She doesn't speak to him for 6 months. He only gets off. The charges are brought. He only gets off by filing an affidavit in the Court of Star Chamber in which he commits perjury by saying that Davison had actually given him permission from the Queen to send the warrant, and so on.
So he tells a lie to get out of it. So that is the end of Mary, Queen of Scots. And we'll move on to Cecil's attitude to making war. The Spanish Armada's on the way now. He's got Sir Francis Drake, who stops playing bowls, gets in his ships, and there's a big wind, which helps.
Should we start before then? Because I think it's important to note that Cecil considers France to be the greater enemy for a long time in Elizabeth's reign. And this is, again, due to Mary, Queen of Scots. She spent a lot of time in France, and her uncles are the members of the Guise family who are French Catholics, important French Catholics. So the danger, as far as Cecil is concerned, comes from France. Furthermore, England has very good trade relations with Spain. It's not just that Antwerp is the centre for English cloth, but there's a lot of merchants who trade directly with the Iberian Peninsula, and they often lobby William Cecil to tell him that, you know, there must be nothing done to endanger their pockets and that trade. So he's very supportive of keeping a relationship, if at all possible, on good terms with Spain. Okay, he will try to make things difficult for Spain, especially after a revolt breaks out in the Netherlands when Protestants, co-religionists of Elizabeth, are fighting for their lives, as well as later on from independence from Spain. But he wants to keep it low-key and underground help for those Protestants. He doesn't support, for example, Francis Drake going around the world. And when Francis Drake brings the bullion back, he basically wants to hand it back to Spain, whereas others want to keep it in the Tower of London, which is what happens. So it's only really in the mid-1580s that Cecil realises there's no other option but to directly engage with Spain.
John.
But his policy is always to fight a defensive war. He resists Robert Dudley, the Earl of Leicester, in sending an expeditionary force to the Netherlands for a while, and then it becomes inevitable. Once the war has started, he agrees totally with Elizabeth on this. They are always shoulder to shoulder, that it should be a defensive war and not the sort of aggressive war, either on the sea that Walter Raleigh wants to fight or on land that the Earl of Essex wants to fight.
And even before the Spanish Armada, both of them together have openings to Spain, the Duke of Parma, trying to get peace negotiations. And it's only when the Spanish Armada takes place that the two of them have to recognise this is all-out war.
Ahmed, you've written the massive book on Thomas Cromwell. Is there any sense in which Cecil is learning from Cromwell?
Oh, completely. Yeah, I mean, Cromwell shaped an England which William Cecil did not change. The great patterns were set in the 1530s. The pattern of government with a Privy Council, with Parliament playing increasing roles in agreeing to decisions and occasionally actually initiating decisions, a system of a civil service, of information. We've talked about Cecil poring over documents. Well, Cromwell had set that precedent. You just have to know things. And Cecil really, for all the things that we've talked about, the intense firefighting for 40 years in political crises again and again and again, there is very little political or structural change under Cecil. Once they sorted the coinage out, we talked about that at the very beginning of the reign, huge achievement. There really isn't much innovation at all. Taxation sort of gets fossilised. And in that sense, he's a rather conservative politician. But Cromwell lurking behind him as the Protestant statesman who showed him what to do.
Ewan Guy, there's the problem of Elizabeth's marriage, which she broke down in tears in front of the Privy Council, one of you says, when she was told she couldn't marry the Duke of Anjou.
I think that was quite theatrical, though. I think this was designed to impress the French ambassador. The thing is, I mean, the obvious question is, if Cecil was so capable, why couldn't he produce the ideal candidate for Elizabeth to marry? Because after all, I mean, Cecil's almost leitmotif was God send our mistress a husband and by him a son that our posterity may be ruled by a masculine succession. And I think he really did think he had found the ideal candidate in the 1560s, just after Elizabeth had the smallpox epidemic and, you know, might well have died, because he is at the front of a campaign to persuade Elizabeth to marry the Archduke Charles of Austria, the third son of the Emperor, the Holy Roman Emperor Ferdinand I, and that runs on till 1567. The miscalculation was that they all thought that that Charles was more flexible in religion than he actually was, Elizabeth and I think Cecil too would not allow him private masses in his own chapel should he come to England. But I think actually it's often said, and the consensus for a long time has been that Elizabeth didn't marry, you know, in great part because her counsellors could never agree on a candidate. But I do think that Elizabeth herself was actually extremely reluctant when it came to the, you know, to the push to marry. And there are conditions that she puts on Charles, which are, you know, not just can he not have private masses, that basically there's to be a reverse dowry. He has to pay a dowry. You know, usually the woman, you know, gives the a dowry. Also, he's not to have any right or title to the crown. He's got no rights of succession, all of those things.
Sue, how much power did Cecil have at the height of his power?
Huge amount. Not enough to persuade Elizabeth to do what she didn't want to do. That's certain.
For instance?
Well, for example, he couldn't persuade her to exclude Mary, Queen of Scots, from the succession. He couldn't persuade her to name a successor. He couldn't persuade her to allow nonconformists in religion to go their own way and not to be deprived of their livings. There were many ways in which Elizabeth made the final decision. But nevertheless, within the Elizabethan regime, he has to be considered the most powerful man. He was the one everybody wrote to in order to try and get his suit settled. He controlled Elizabeth's correspondence for most of the reign, certainly when he was the secretary. He could massage information to put it in a way that might influence Elizabeth.
Is it true that when letters were sent to her, he read them first and read them aloud to her and then allowed her to tamper with them?
Well, I think it wasn't that he allowed her to. I think she preferred him to read it. Sometimes she would read the letters herself, but very often we know that he read them to her, or parts of the letter, or he summarised the letters. That's a very powerful position. And as he said himself, I am no clerk as secretary. He saw himself as Elizabeth's leading counsellor, and indeed he was.
Did he also see himself as her leading courtier? And how did these two things play?
He wasn't a natural extrovert, and he rather played on that. He had a favourite mule he liked to ride on, and it's a very sort of humble animal. It's a bit of a pose, because, of course, he made huge sums of money and built magnificent houses. But the courtier image was not him. There were people around who could do that. There was Robert Dudley, Earl of Leicester, for instance, and later on the Earl of Essex. He's not that sort of guy. He's much more the sort of statesman like Thomas Cromwell.
He's been a bit holier than thou. Did his affection for Spain had anything to do with the fact that he and his son had shares in trade with Spain?
Well, no doubt it helped. But there is a rationale here. We've already mentioned Antwerp. That's the natural trading nexus for England. I mean, the cloth trade is just utterly dependent on that. So whoever ruled Antwerp was going to be the obvious partner for England, and that was the Habsburg monarch, the King of Spain at that stage.
But just to want to persist for one second about the taxation system, which was ridiculously corrupt, and the tax he paid on the immense sums he earned was, I think it was your phrase, ridiculously low, or yours, John.
Absolutely. I mean, he was constantly worrying about money, finance of government, and yet he himself was not paying a good whack. And the nobility and gentry generally were not. The tax system was a problem postponed during Elizabeth's reign.
It's self-assessment. That's the big change, of course, from Wolsey and Thomas Cromwell. It's self-assessment from the 1560s onwards. And Cecil declares his income to be exactly the same as it was in the reign of Edward VI. It's simply stereotyped.
So that's that. Let's talk about how he arranges smooth successions. He dies before Elizabeth died, but nevertheless the succession is very smooth. It's bloodless and so on. What part did he play in that? How did he prepare for that, sir?
Well, he didn't play any part in it when it really happened.
No, not actively, because he was dead. But,
yes,
I mean, he prepared for it.
He prepared for it in the sense that his son, Robert Cecil, I would say, picked up on his idea, which was that if Elizabeth died without a successor, there should be a grand council where the nobility and the council, privy council, that really shouldn't exist anymore because the Queen is dead. All her councillors had no more positions. But he allowed there to be this great council, and he planned for it, Cecil, which Robert took her up, which decided that James VI should be King of England. Now, what William Cecil, had expected would be that this Grand Council would actually choose the next successor. But by the time that Robert was making the decisions and making the arrangements, there really was nobody else that was going to be in line for the throne.
What can we say, coming towards the end here now, Dermot, what can we say changed under the Tudors because of Cecil?
That the realm survived as an increasingly important Protestant power, that's the change, because we started with a really fragile regime and with two brief reigns, Edward and Mary, England being a marginal power. And then Elizabeth came along to turn it into something which was really quite dangerous to do, to create a Protestant power. And Cecil's achievement was to make that solid, make it safe. I don't think he ever ceased to worry, but between 1558 and his death in 1598, England had settled down in a Protestant Reformation, and it would be extremely difficult to reverse it, whereas in 1558 it would have been quite easy.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much, John Guide, Sue Doran and Dermot McCulloch. Next week, what does it mean to be oneself? We'll discuss the idea of authenticity from Aristotle to Sartre and since. Thanks for listening.
And the In Our Time podcast gets some extra time now with a few minutes of bonus material from Melvin and his guests.
Well, thank you for that. Gosh. If there's more to say, please say it now.
Well, there is, isn't there? And we were just overwhelmed by information, just as he was. I think the one thing, the charming thing, but important thing we ought to have talked about is gardens.
Well, I was going to say Tybalt's. I mean, it's a magnificent house. It's a house for a king, and indeed James took it over.
Well, I mean, he created the great houses, but around them was the
garden. The gardens.
And that's a mark of his being a humanist-trained statesman, isn't it? Because this idea idea of order and harmony. The gardens teach you lessons, but they are also a place that you are at your most human. They are around you to express civilization and so on. That's very much his idea. And of course, his brother-in-law did the same thing, the great Sir Nicholas Bacon. They were both huge garden enthusiasts.
But I think it also shows the influence of Italy. We're saying that he's not a courtier, but actually he read a lot of the works about how courtiers should live. And he also was influenced by Italian architecture and Italian garden design. Mm.
He was the patron of John Gerard, who wrote The Great Herbal. Yes. And Gerard's great coup working for Cecil was to discover the hothouse. So Cecil actually had plants from Chile, Peru, Japan. He had exotic plants, and of course he would show them off. And in these wonderful Italian gardens with fountains, and when Elizabeth came to stay, she walked through the alleys, and they would have banquets, which is basically, you know, sweet wine and sort of comfits, mostly sugar comfits. Elizabeth had a very sweet tooth somewhere in the garden on the late summer evenings. I think also, actually, although these are part of a sort of tremendous Renaissance type display, there are also actually gardening wars at the court of Elizabeth I, because you know, courtiers were actually competing to have the... There was much less factionalism at the Elizabethan court than used to be thought, but they would compete and show off, you know, I've got the best garden. And certainly Robert Dudley and Cecil were competing in that way. The buildings, too. I mean, he built Burley House. He had stuff sent over from Antwerp. He had marble, he had alabaster, he had a whole gallery sent over from Antwerp, which Thomas Gresham arranged for him. And then he was building, as Sue has said, on a huge grand scale at Tibbles, which is just by junction 25 of the M25. It doesn't exist now. It used to be the Tesco Management Centre, but you can't see anything very much there now. But of course, it had three huge courts and was as grand as most royal palaces.
It was.
And we kept talking about Italy, and I think the one thing which people don't appreciate is that you think Italy is Catholic. Well, of course, the Pope lives there. But in fact, in the 1520s, 30s, 40s, that was not the main identity of Italy. It was likely to have a Protestant Reformation like everywhere else. So Italian interest, Italian architecture, is not Catholic. Mm. It is Protestant.
Or it is just courtly.
It
doesn't necessarily have a confessional tone to it.
Right. So all the great statesmen of mid-Tudor England would build magnificent Renaissance houses as they understood the Renaissance style. Mm. It's not associated with Catholicism. Mm.
Another point I think that's important is that he thought to the future, because in his household he brought in wards, important noblemen, who he was their guardian as the master of the court of wards, and they would be educated or were educated in his household. He arranged marriages for them. The Earl of Oxford married, unfortunately, very sadly, his daughter Anne. But these were the men he thought were going to take over in the next generation, so that he would influence them in the ways of being good counsellors and good Protestants.
Actually, that leads us on to the one thing we've not said, and we should, that his great interest, as with all Tudor statesmen, was to create a dynasty. Mm. And his eldest son was a bit of a waste of space, who became Lord Burley and by hereditary right. But then the second son we've talked about, Robert Cecil, now he is as great a statesman.
Yes.
And went on to be the chief leading politician in the early part of James I's reign. But beyond that, the Cecils, they're one of the great names in English history, thanks to William Cecil.
Yes.
You think of Victorian prime ministers when you think of the Cecils, as well as Elizabethan statesmen. Now there is a triumphant achievement, and that's probably the one he'd have relished most of all his achievements.
He was terribly interested in genealogy and traced his family back to William, you know, the Conqueror, with sort of quite misleading results, had coats of arms. I mean, he was very chummy with the heralds who would, you know, supply him with all of this information. I mean, that passion, though, is on a sort of passion with his interest in maps and cosmography and which had a political purpose. But he was also interested in maps, actually, simply from a Renaissance and humanist perspective too, that this was how you understood the world better.
Well,
Did he have any friends?
Lots, I think.
Real friends?
Lots. Oh, yes. And that's part of the clubbability of the man.
Yes, he had dinners where people would enjoy merry conversation, as one of his biographers said, contemporary biographers. Yes, he had people who wrote, two people who wrote lives of the life of Cecil immediately afterwards, people he was close to. Yeah.
I'd say the Queen was a friend.
Oh, definitely.
This is not just a professional relationship. No. It's friendship there. And that's why she could get in such a rage with him.
Yeah. An odd relationship, though, isn't it? I mean, the more we find out, especially the recent stuff, where she turns out to be rather more indecisive than we thought. And
yeah. Well, I think so. I don't think every historian, Jude historian, would necessarily agree with that. But I think that certainly at the beginning of the reign, she was much more vulnerable, and I mean, she was relatively young, just 25 when she took the throne. I mean, there's no doubt that she was having to learn how to cope with Cecil. I mean, there are quotations that we can say that, you know, speak directly to us. One is when Robert Jones, the English ambassador to France, secretary came to London in 1560. He came over with news from Throckmorton, who was the ambassador, but he saw Elizabeth, and we don't know exactly what he told Elizabeth, but the next day he was sent for. He complains about this. He was sent for the next day and given a real telling off by Cecil, who said, "You should not have told the Queen a matter of such weight, being too much for a woman's knowledge." And over Scotland, in the winter of 1559 to 60, Elizabeth didn't want to deal with Scotland. In fact, Cecil talked her into, and against much advice from the Privy Council too, at that time, into sending a force up to Scotland to hold the Protestant lords. But when Elizabeth wouldn't do this, certainly for quite a long time at first, he wrote a letter which he may or may not have sent. If he didn't send it, it was left in a drawer, and we can read it. And it says, "To serve your Majesty in anything that I cannot allow must be an unprofitable service." He also wrote to Matthew Parker, the then Archbishop of Canterbury, and he said, because he wrote many of Elizabeth's letters in draft, and I mean, she did read them through, but I mean, the politics between Elizabeth and Cecil are the politics of the letter writing, you know, which he controls to a very considerable degree, and she is keeping him at bay on controversial subjects. But he says to Matthew Parker, "You're going to get a letter from the Queen next week. I've just written it. It might be a little bit too long. Have a look and see what you think. If there's anything that you want taken out, I'll take it out. If there's anything you want put in, I'll put it in. The one thing that worries me is that the Queen might, because some of it concerns the Reformation, the Queen may try to alter it more than I shall allow." Now, that's interesting language. That speaks for itself.
And you've all spoken very well for yourselves. Thank you very much. Here's our producer.
Does anyone want to your coffee?
Yeah, I wouldn't mind a tea.
Tea would be great.
Tea would be lovely.
Earl Grey, but ordinary would be all right.
I think we have got Earl Grey.
A bit of tea would be lovely, thank you.
In Our Time with Melvyn Bragg is produced by Simon Tillotson.
Hello, I'm Greg Foot, and I'm hosting a new Radio 4 podcast called The Best Things Since Sliced Bread. Have you ever wondered what's fact and what's fad when it comes to wonder products? Face creams, activated charcoal, kombucha, turmeric shots? That's what I'm trying to find out with the help of leading scientists and special guests. If you want to separate benefits from bunkum, subscribe to The Best Things Since Sliced Bread on BBC Sounds.
Selling a little? Or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/ upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.